At this festive time of year, with the hours left until Christmas shortening, it is more than usually desirable that we should make some slight provision for our friends and family with whom we pass the holiday. It's a commonly shared custom to exchange gifts, lest one be determined a humbug, so begets the dilemma of choosing the appropriate indulgence for everyone on your tally. And I entreat you to consider this solution. Coffee is a widely enjoyed beverage among adults, and among those who indulge in it, most appreciate the flavor of high-quality fresh coffee. And so may it be that these lucky companions might happily and thankfully receive Sparkplug Coffee from you as a holiday token. Sparkplug Coffee is made from premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. Their varieties and roasts span to please any tongue. And Sparkplug even relieves you of the duty of collecting and dispensing this gift to your fellows as it delivers this coffee to the front door of the lucky recipient, and all with the promise of freshness so that all the senses are pleased by its product. For thrifty celebrators like the hero of our story, one might simply use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. And do know that it is all one word with the number 100 to make the noble adjustment of 20% savings on your forthcoming order. So, to delight your fellow passengers to the grave, I entreat you to honor Christmas in your heart and plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Put a little spark plug in your cup.
Top 100 Project
and action.
Merry season, movie chums, and thanks for dumping the 421st Ellis's analysis directly into your life. We are the podcast that looks back at classic movies and spoils the holy shit out of them. We also spoiled each of the 123 AFI greats on the 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists, hence our original name, the Top 100 Project. And we even talked about a movie Bill Murray was in on those lists, Tootsie. We've covered him a lot. We'll talk about that as the podcast goes on, but that was the AFI film he was in. I'm the lumpy guy who was a schmuck, and now I'm not a schmuck. Well, maybe I'm still a schmuck, but that's a line from the film. Ryan Ellis. And here's the socially conscious cutie who has made this particular employee of a television station a better man, my wife Bev.
That's me.
But is it believable in his case or in mine? We will discuss that as we go along, too.
I have a lot to say about you, sir.
I have a lot to say about Bill Murray. Okay, the coming attractions opinion question for our Christmas week episode of the Top 100 Project, Ellis's Analysis. It is Scrooged. And the director was Richard Donner. Dick Donner did direct many different types of movies. He did horror in The Omen. Superman, of course, was a superhero flick and one of the first, maybe the very first? Well, anyway, one of the first big-budget ones, and I liked it a lot. He did action comedy in the Lethal Weapon franchise. He worked with a big cast of kids in comedy adventure picture The Goonies, another favorite of mine from childhood. And he even did a Western, which was Maverick, and a fantasy period piece, which was Lady Hawk. And there's certainly more than those, but he covered a lot of genres. So, what do you think he was best at?
I'm going to say action comedy. None of Donner's movies have aged exceptionally well, but the 80s, the late 80s, it was just totally owned by Lethal Weapon. And you could totally argue also that Goonies and Maverick are action comedies. Maverick is more action comedy than a traditional Western, I would say.
Probably true.
But Lethal Weapon especially, those movies were just on a loop in my house growing up, and they were just so damn watchable. And what say you?
Well, my answer is I think Lethal Weapon was right in his wheelhouse more than any other genre. And I still enjoy the first two of those, which were sandwiched around today's movie, Scrooge.
Yeah.
87 and 89, Lethal Weapon 1 and 2. And then Scrooge was 88. Lethal Weapon and Scrooge are both Christmas movies, and Lethal Weapon actually incorporates it quite a bit. Not as much as Scrooge does. But I will always be a Superman guy. Who is it, Superman? The world is safe against Superman.
You can like Superman.
Thanks to you.
I totally get how there's a nostalgia element there because that was the superhero movie in the early 80s.
Late 70s.
When I was growing up in the early 80s, Superman was still the only superhero franchise. And my family loved them. We watched all of them.
Mm.
But you have to admit, it's been surpassed by just about every superhero movie made since.
I didn't say it hasn't. I just think I like it. Well, then again, Lethal Weapon I've seen many times, and I like that. Your brother-in-law says he thinks it aged badly. I don't really agree. I like Lethal Weapon. I've seen it many times. I know Mel Gibson's the worst thing in the history of the world, but he's a good actor, and he was well cast in those movies as Riggs. Obviously, Danny Glover as Murtaugh. They made four of those films. Even three and four are entertaining.
There's a few things in those movies that have aged pretty poorly, but nothing worse than the saxophone soundtrack.
I think that's fine in those movies. You know what you're watching when you watch those movies. So yes, he's probably best at that kind of film. But I think Superman is my favorite of his films. But we've only ever covered him once before. It was The Omen. And that's what's fascinating. He does a horror movie, put him on the map, after doing TV for a long time, which is one reason why there's this live television element. He wasn't an executive, but he was a live television director.
He was prolific. His IMDb credits have tons, probably hundreds of TV credits, especially as a director.
But what a range of films. And of course, he's dead now. He lived a long time. All right, then. Scrooged was released by Paramount Pictures on November 23rd, 1988. It wasn't a holiday blockbuster, but its worldwide take was actually pretty solid. But Bev, the movie is years old. Again, my math is failing me. So please do the skinny. Give us the skinny. Tell us the skinny on Scrooged.
I guess it's 33 years old.
That sounds right.
Bill Murray is Frank Cross, a cold-hearted TV executive overseeing a massive live presentation of A Christmas Carol on Christmas Eve. But his plans are interrupted by the arrival of three ghosts who show him how his actions created his lonely situation, hurt people that he loves, and will doom him in the future. So he undergoes a massive change of heart and interrupts his big live show to have a full-blown mental breakdown on live television.
Gonna need you to do that a little bigger, Bev.
Are you playing Richard Donner right now?
Apparently that was one of the controversies with Murray and Donner. They did not work well together. And Murray accused Donner of wanting him to be way too big, and he certainly is in this movie.
It explains his performance.
I'm not really a fan.
Yeah.
Or, in a nutshell, you let the executives go in front of the camera, and look what happens. There's a reason you're not in front of the camera. Or, have yourself a very Murray Christmas. You did not like A Very Murray Christmas.
Did you like
TV
it?
TV movie thing that...
It was objectively terrible.
Sofia Coppola did a couple years ago with Bill Murray. I didn't like it that much either. This is better than that, but I have already made it, I think, pretty clear in this episode and in other episodes before that I am not a Scrooge fan, and I just said it a minute ago. Bill Murray is a great actor. We've covered him so many different times before. Certainly a funny actor, one of the funniest actors of the last 30, 40, 50 years. But I think he's either miscast in this role, or maybe it's more so that he's badly directed by a guy we know can certainly direct actors, and as we just said for the last few minutes, many types of movies. But I'm not a Scrooge fan. I've seen, I think, three, maybe even four times. I never have been. I don't think it's that funny. And I do not buy at all the climax when he has his breakdown, but then his big revelations of, we got to live every day like it's Christmas. We've seen many Christmas Carol Scrooge-type stories. Many actors have played it. I said to Jim Carrey a couple weeks ago, and A Christmas Carol is one of my favorite underrated versions of that character. Alistair Sim is still, I think, the best. Michael Caine in Muppet Christmas Carol is pretty good. But I don't think Murray is right in this role, or he was not well directed. And when you compare to a role that in some ways is similar, that he absolutely aced, Groundhog Day.
I wrote down the exact same thing in my notes, that you have an actor who has one of the best redemption arcs in any movie, especially when you consider it supposed to be a lighthearted comedy. But his redemption arc in Groundhog Day is so sincere and lovely and plays on his strengths because it just lets him be his deadpan self. And his cynicism in that movie feels like it's a shield, like something that he just uses to protect himself. Versus in this movie, they make him so flat out evil in the first act. I think for comedy's sake, probably some of the funniest stuff in the movie is the beginning when you see his terrible promos and the way he treats his staff and the way that he's just so mean to everybody, and it's funny. But it lets the film down if you want to have a convincing arc, which I don't really think they were trying to do anyways. There's no emotional resonance to this movie. I think it's probably pretty hard to get emotional resonance out of any Christmas Carol story because he has to be reticent up until the very end where he has a change of heart when he learns that he is going to die someday.
Alone is the key factor.
I guess that's it, that he's always going to be lonely, and it's that realization, which still feels like a pretty selfish motive compared to the other things that are presented to him, like the way he hurts his brother and his sister-in-law too, or the way he hurts his staff. Obviously, Bob Cratchit in this Alfred Woodard, who is wonderful in this movie, actually brings more heart to the movie than Murray's performance by a long shot. He sees the effect he has on all these people, how he broke Claire's heart, and how without people's help, homeless people really do die in the street, and he actually finds out he doesn't want that to happen. But none of those things redeem him. He still is a jerk up until the very tail end when he's, like, burning in his coffin. And then he bursts out, has this moment of revelation, gives Elliot his job back.
Which is also a bad choice, probably. This guy's been wielding a gun now in his TV station. He probably belongs in jail.
It doesn't matter. Nothing he says that night is going to mean anything because he's going to be either in jail or the loony bin by the end of the night.
Who's the he?
I'm talking about Frank. Elliot. Elliot and Frank are going to get locked up together. Elliot's not getting his job back. Frank, it's a joke that Claire has anything to do with him. Turn your back on this man, lady. What are you doing? You know, speaking of things that are unbelievable, his redemption's unbelievable, but Claire giving him chance after chance after chance after all those years. The idea that she never found love, this completely lovely, beautiful woman with this huge heart and these big doe eyes, right, yeah, she can't get a date. It's Frank or nothing.
Just like in It's a Wonderful Life.
I was thinking the same thing, yeah, like another Christmas movie where there's only one man
who will
have
you. She's gonna die an old maid. She's a spinster. Well, the boss of the station, Robert Mitchum, Preston Rhinelander is the character's name. Can you believe this? After all these years of doing this podcast, we've never covered Robert Mitchum before, and as this movie is the first one with a pretty small role and not really a Robert Mitchum-type performance.
Well, help me out. I can't say I'm super familiar with Robert Mitchum.
A lot of noir films, quite a few westerns. We were going to do Night of the Hunter a couple years ago, or I guess last year, when it would have been...
Oh, that's a movie that's been on my shortlist for a long time.
Blank years old. Plays a great villain in that. He was in the original Cape Fear. And there are many other films we could have done. I've always liked Mitchum an awful lot, and I was just surprised to see, thinking we must have covered at least one thing he did. But no, this would be the first time ever. But he seems like he's going to fire Frank anyway when he first goes on camera, meaning when Frank goes on camera. But then when Frank convinces everybody, no, live every day like it's Christmas. Again, I don't believe that he's actually convincing anybody. He certainly isn't convincing me.
Kissing a rocket.
But everybody's dancing.
Quoting other movies that he's been in.
He's happy with his wife. So the implication is that Preston's changed his mind. But why? Because why do you trust Frank, who's just gone through this insane breakdown, like you said earlier, but also... The production that he greenlit in the first place must have been so expensive. And I guess people were going to watch this because he made them afraid not to watch it. As he said, that's his whole angle. But who really watches TV on Christmas Eve? Not that many people do. There's a reason why there aren't really any great things to watch on Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and even probably Boxing Day here in Canada anyway. I'm sure that New Year's is about the same.
But you know why the show aired on Christmas Eve, right, Ryan? Because the story of A Christmas Carol takes place on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, but a television executive shouldn't be allowed to greenlight something, especially this big a production. And, of course, he's being a Grinch, a Scrooge, by having them all work so late. You know what's funny about the Scrooge story, too? Now, we've covered the most famous one, I think the most famous one, the 1951 Alistair Sim version, Christmas Carol. We did that
2017, because I looked up my notes.
2016 must have been, because it would have been
blank
years old. Again, I can't do the math. What is that, 65 years old? Maybe we talked about it in that podcast. People have talked about this before, that why is the Scrooge name associated with bad guy when most of his life, maybe not most of his life, but a lot of his life, like they say in the voiceover at the end of the 1951, he was as good a man and as good a master as the old city ever knew. Everybody liked him. He helped save Tiny Tim. He was obviously a friend of the Cratchits,
sure,
yet the storyline is always that he was an evil guy, but through many years of his life, he would have been not only a good guy, but a great guy.
But that's the epilogue. When you ask yourself, why is A Christmas Carol such an enduring story? I think after Jesus and Santa, Scrooge, Ebenezer Scrooge, might be the third most enduring popular character associated with Christmas. So what draws audiences to it? I think people love to see a rich asshole who's miserable. There's an appeal of watching this rich, mean boss get a firm dressing down and being reduced to a crying mess. We like to be reminded that these bullies deep down are sad and weak, and that's a satisfying thing to see. There's a universal appeal of a transformation and that happy ending, but I think what really brings people to this story over and over again is watching a mean person suffer.
Well, is it either Chuck Jones or Dr. Seuss that said about How the Grinch Loves Christmas, the 1966 TV movie? We also covered that. And one of the two of them said, everybody hates Christmas a little bit.
A little bit, sir? I'd say I'm 50-50 between loving Christmas and hating Christmas.
Partly it's the weather. You never know if we're going to be in for a big blizzard and then caught somewhere. And oh, God.
Just the flurry of expectations and obligations.
The obligations, especially.
Yeah, just piling up. Too much of a good thing sometimes.
And he does say it in this movie, but the key line that Scrooge always has is, bah humbug. And humbug, as I've explained before, simply is supposed to mean, I think you're faking it. Merry Christmas, Mr. Scrooge. I don't believe you. That's what humbug is supposed to mean.
Calling someone a phony.
Yeah. Mm. All right, so you're a fan of this movie. I'm not really a fan of this movie, but the critics are. Not by a ton, but they are. Rotten Tomatoes, 69% of them say yes. 69, The average is 6 out of 10, and the strength of 49 reviews and 71% of audiences. It was 13th at the 1988 U.S. box office. We covered a lot of movies from that year. Rain Man, the Best Picture winner, was number one. Who Framed Roger Rabbit was number two. Big was number four. Die Hard, Christmas movie, despite Bruce Willis's insistence, it's a Bruce Willis movie. No, it wasn't. You weren't a star then, you selfish asshole. That was number seven. A Fish Called Wanda was number 12, and Bull Durham was number 18. We have covered every one of those. And this movie was nominated for one Oscar, did not win it. Beetlejuice did. That was for the makeup. And that has to be almost entirely for the John Forsythe scenes. He's the old boss, Lou. And that's pretty damn good makeup. And even though sometimes the visual effects are crappy in this, I'm a little bit surprised that that wasn't nominated, mostly because 1988, pre-digital.
And you have like a variety of effects. You have the special effects of him pushing him through the window. Very convincing, absolutely terrifying. And then you have the puppet effects of the Ghost of Christmas Future.
Mm-hmm. Which is supposed to be the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come, but they call Christmas Future in this. Okay, we're past the intros to all this. I said you liked the movie, but then I did re-listen to one of our old podcasts, and it happened to come up in that one, Christmas Vacation. And you said you weren't as much of a fan of this movie as you used to be. That was 2 years ago. Now that we've seen it, what do you think of Scrooged in 2021?
Yeah, I really loved this movie when it first came out.
And you did laugh a lot watching it a few days ago.
Yeah, and it was one of my go-to Christmas movies every year. I was younger, first of all, but also it was just one of the rare Christmas movies that was a straight comedy. This and Christmas Vacation, and not a ton of examples that are also good movies.
Christmas Story?
That's not a straight comedy the way these two are just, that's their whole purpose is being a comedy. And a black comedy at that.
I respect what they're trying to do, by the way. I really respect the idea of going dark with this story. Even at the end, the redemption part is not pure. I don't think it works, but I respect what they're trying to do at least.
So for me, I think back then it really stood out for being more cynical than sentimental. That's my jam. Since then, though, I think people with offbeat senses of humor have a lot more to choose from. And Scrooge just doesn't hold a candle to, say, Bad Santa. If you want a Christmas movie that's really dark and bleak, it's just a better movie altogether. So that probably replaced it for me as my go-to dark Christmas movie.
Billy Bob in that movie, yeah, similar character to this one. Doesn't really have a true redemption in jail. Somewhat of a redemption, though, because he is determined to get that stuffed animal to the kid at Christmas. Probably wouldn't have gotten shot the way he was in his fucked up liver if he wasn't so insistent upon that.
Ha, ha, ha.
We will watch Bad Santa. Well, we record this the very beginning of December. We will have watched it before this podcast goes up, I'm sure.
Well, Bad Santa benefited from the fact that the script was written by the Coen brothers. Now, according to the screenwriters of Scrooge, who are Mitch Glazer and Michael O'Donoghue, they had just as good of a script. A masterpiece.
Bill Murray apparently O'Donoghue agreed
with them. And Bill Murray agreed. All three of them said Donner ruined it. He didn't get it. He doesn't get comedy, which is just plainly untrue. He's made lots of funny movies. Mm. But I guess his comic sensibility didn't match with the script. And they said that most of the best stuff from their screenplay didn't find its way on screen. They thought the movie was terrible. For years, Murray, if it came up, didn't even want to talk about it in interviews. He considered it one of the worst things he worked on. And he worked on this movie after taking a 4-year hiatus from just being overwhelmed by all of the brouhaha that happened after Ghostbusters, that he was just a little overwhelmed by getting that famous that fast and by all of his success. So he took a breather, and this was the first feature film that he made in, well, I think he did a few cameos here and there. But
yeah, he was in movies. They make it sound like he wasn't in any movies online, but he was in movies, just not in a starring role. And then he comes back, and he probably thought, for this experience?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I read the same things you did about those guys, the three of them, Glazer, O'Donoghue, and Murray, not liking what came out of it. O'Donoghue worked on SNL, wrote for them. I didn't see if it was during Murray's time, but they both have that experience. And the Mitch Glazer did other things, but was an associate producer on Lost in Translation, so they worked together again in the future. When I read that part, though, they said, or Murray's, the part I read first, great screenplay, Donna ruined it. But you're the improv king. You're the one that wants to always go off script. Apparently in Kingpin, he didn't read almost anything that they wrote for him. He's very funny in that movie, and I think the whole movie's quite funny. So it worked there. It's worked in a lot of things he's done. I'm sure he improvised a ton in Ghostbusters as well. But where is this great screenplay you're talking about if you're supposed to be the improv king? Or is it maybe that in this case I would have followed the letter of the law, but then Donner fucked it up, so I'm going to do my own thing. But then the other thing becomes, especially in that end sequence, need more from you, Bill. Bigger, bigger, bigger. And he just seems so desperate.
Hmm.
Bill Murray could play desperate. Groundhog Day.
What
the
about
scenes,
Bob?
That's definitely, yeah. But the scenes in Groundhog Day when he tries to recapture that perfect day he had with Andy McDowell falling down in the snow and then there? No, is it there? Is it there? He can do it in small doses especially. He can probably do it in big doses. But that's why I don't like the ending of this movie, because that's one of the best things. Well, it is the best thing about the Scrooge story is the redemption, of course. When I watched A Christmas Carol on my own a year or two ago, because I know you don't want to ever see it again, meaning the Sim version.
Never again.
I did watch the whole thing, but then, I think it was last year, I just literally started it from the part where he wakes up, oh, spit it, no, I can change, because that stuff is great, including the, you there, boy. But the point is, this is a strange story that has a great climax. It's been done so many different times before. They don't really even go off what was done before as far as the basic idea. But I think I always believed that this guy was redeemed. And he doesn't have to be redeemed, if that's what you want to do with your movie. But I think you're trying to, and you failed! Murray did, Donner did, they all did.
That scene is so bad that even though it's maybe the last 5 minutes of the film, it drags the whole movie down. It's such a mess. So Donner wanted Murray to just follow the script, which was based on apparently this idea that New Yorkers are nice to each other for one night on Christmas Eve and it's so special. And then Murray went way off script, forgot about the blocking, just delivered this manic, crazy performance, which makes you wonder how many things. It is on him that he improvised. And maybe this was him at the end of a miserable shoot of butting heads with Donner and Donner constantly telling him to go bigger and him being like, you want me to go big? Okay, here it is. Here's the biggest thing you've ever seen. I'm going to completely ruin this scene. At the end, he starts quoting Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah.
Non sequitur. And he's in Little Shop of Horrors. So it's not like it's just a movie that would be normal to quote. It's completely out of context and very meta in the sense that, no, sir, in the universe that you live in, Little Shop of Horrors can't exist because you're an actor in that film. It's so freaking weird. And it's insane to me that they saw him do this and then just decided to go with this version instead of getting something better, getting a safety. It could be because they had to duke it out over everything, and maybe Donner was also at his wit's end at this point and is like, I don't want to die on this hill. I've had it with fighting with this man. The crew broke into applause after he was done. Maybe he was caught up in the moment too, because that's what it can be when you're in the space with a great improviser. And more than one person said Donner didn't know how to direct Murray. He didn't know how to work with improvisers. He was just out of his depth when it came to working with him. They were just so incompatible. There was a great movie that could have been made. This could have been like an absolute knock out of the park Christmas classic, but the stars didn't align.
So you were a fan of this movie most of your life, maybe not so much a couple years ago when we talked about it during Christmas Vacation. Where do you rank it now? Is this a thumb up for you? Is it below that?
Honestly, after watching it this time, I can't say that I dislike it.
You laughed more than I did.
I laughed. I enjoyed it fine, but especially because you don't like it, I don't see myself ever going out of my way to watch it again. My mom loves it, so I'll watch it with her because watching a comedy that my mom loves, it's its own kind of delight because she has the most ridiculous over-the-top laugh and she has the corniest sense of humor. Mm. Worst sense of humor. Oh my god, she's so basic, but then it just is funny in and of itself.
Yeah, okay.
So I could see myself watching it with her.
She's not alone, by the way. She's the majority. I mentioned the Rotten Tomatoes numbers, and I think if you just talk to regular people, many of them will say this is in their top five Christmas movies.
It made all kinds of lists of best Christmas movies of all time. And I'm not talking that it was number 50. I'm talking it was number 5 on this one list I saw. Not like I think Christmas movies is the greatest, most rich genre of film there is. But I can certainly name easily 5 Christmas movies that are better than Scrooge.
You know, it's funny you say that you don't think there are that many great Christmas movies. There's a reason why we don't do a Christmas month every year like we do a Halloween month or Scary Movie month.
Yeah.
We've almost always done more than the 4 or so in October. We've usually had 1 or 2 in September, especially the last couple of years. And then sometimes in April or January or May, whatever it might be. It happens to be a horror film, but we didn't put it in that month. Christmas films, there are still plenty we could do, but we're getting to the point now where the best ones are in our past.
That's because why we're covering Wonderful Scrooge.
Life. Well, Scrooge is a popular film. I bet this gets a decent amount of downloads, and they're probably going to hate my guts, and maybe even you too for not liking it. but I think I've made clear why I don't. I wish that this movie had been able to maintain the tone it set in the beginning. When we see the silly shows that Frank has put on the air, or the promos for them, I guess.
The night the reindeer die.
The Santa and the elves arming themselves scene with machine guns. That was probably fairly creative in 1988. I think we've probably seen that kind of thing since.
This is one Santa who goes through the front door.
Lee Majors has a pretty funny cameo, and this is a lot of cameos in this. Murray's brothers are in this, all three of them. So John is his actual brother, and he plays his brother in the film. Brian Doyle plays his dad, and of course he's with him in Groundhog Day.
And his brother, that has the smallest part in this movie, arguably had the best career. Well, I guess...
Is it Joel?
Yeah, well, I just say that because...
Brian Doyle had a better career other than Bill Murray himself.
I guess so. Maybe it's just how much I love Mad Men, and he was a principal in Mad Men for, I think, the entire run of that show.
Oh, I forgot. Who was he in that again?
He's just one of the bro-y ad dudes.
What a great guys. Role. You can't remember what it is. Awesome role.
Well, I can't remember exactly what his position was, but he worked at the advertising firm. He worked at Sterling Cooper.
Anyway, all the Murray brothers are in this. One plays his father, one plays his actual brother. And then you've got all the great cameos. I mentioned Lee Majors a minute ago, and they're playing themselves, mostly. John Houseman is playing the narrator of A Christmas Carol. Buddy Hackett and Jamie Farr, Scrooge and Cratchit in the performance. Robert Goulet is one of the other shows.
The actual Solid Gold Dancers.
Right. And Mary Lou Retton has almost as much screen time as those other guys because she's Tiny Tim. We see her
acrobat.
We see her a few times doing her thing.
I obviously love this movie more than I'm admitting to because I cannot stop quoting it.
That's fine. You'll love it.
See? It's caught you,
well,
too.
Well, that's corny.
It's supposed to be corny, Ryan.
Early on, Mitchum's character says that cats and dogs watch TV, and we gotta cater to them. Well, I didn't know this until reading this online, so I assumed they're right. I should have checked up on it, I guess, but there are now channels for pets.
I believe it.
I guess maybe because people say they leave TVs on for cats and dogs when they leave to keep them company, and it makes sense to be a pet-type show.
There's also, just on cable alone, hundreds and hundreds of channels. And then, if you go on YouTube, if you can imagine it...
That makes sense.
It's on YouTube.
Well, of course, the overlying theme in this story has always been the ghosts that scare him straight. Lou's ghost, very effective, a former boss. No different than the partner, being Marley, in the actual story. And all this talk about ghosts, and it's a Ghostbuster for the star.
Apparently one of the taglines for the film was, Bill Murray meets up with ghosts again, only this time it's three against one. I was guilty of saying this in the skinny. We always say, three ghosts. There's four ghosts, because Marley is a ghost.
It's true. In the original story, that's true, too. And also, in the original story, this is different. Lou says, you'll see a ghost at noon on Christmas Eve, rather than over the course of the next, I think, 2 or 3 days, according to the story. But then it's even in at least the Sim version, where he says, they did it all in one night. So I'm not really sure why that's done that way. Anyway, the point is that he sees ghosts during the day while he's just living his life on Christmas Day, gets an award. Okay, here's the thing we haven't talked about at all yet. He's always drinking.
Oh, yeah. He's,
so maybe he's just imagining all of this because he's so soused.
Also, did you notice we never once see where he lives? We see him at the office.
He lives at work.
But he basically lives at work. They're definitely painting him as a workaholic, which is true of Ebenezer Scrooge, too. And I think they paint a really good picture
of
an alcoholic.
But most of Scrooge's story is set in his place and having this weird fever dream fantasy with all the ghosts. Carol Kane is the middle one. She's the ghost of Christmas Present. We've seen her in other movies we've covered, including The Princess Bride. David Johansen, who is the ghost of Christmas Past, has probably the most screen time of the ghosts. I thought I recognized him from something else, and I couldn't place him in anything else other than this.
That's because he goes by David Johansen now. He's also known as Buster Poindexter.
Okay, I know that name. What is that, though?
So, you probably wouldn't know him from a band called the New York Dolls.
I know that name.
Okay, but that's where he became famous, and then he acted. I can't think of other things he's been in either, but it just feels like one of those people who's omnipresent here and there in culture, especially in the 80s. Sort of like Tom Waits, where you don't think of a specific Tom Waits role or movie.
He could have played this character.
He totally could have played this character. There's an interesting story with David Johansen, though, because... Okay, the story goes, this movie was on TV, and his old bandmate, the bassist from the New York Dolls, happened to catch it and was so overcome with jealousy, I guess, professional jealousy, that he beat up his girlfriend and then jumped out of a third-story window, almost killing himself but surviving. And then while he was in the hospital recovering from his injuries, he was converted to Mormonism, and I think was a Mormon for the rest of his life.
Oh.
he just had a total nervous breakdown that was triggered by seeing his buddy in this movie. Being great. I think he's great. A very over-the-top performance, but all of the ghosts, yeah, all the ghosts have very over-the-top performances. Sam and Carol Kane, the ghosts of Christmas Yet to Come, as you say.
Carol Kane goes big almost all the time, too.
If you want to be deafened by my mom's laugh, you just have to sit down and watch the Carol Kane scenes with her, where she's beating him up over and over again.
Okay.
Oh man, my mom loves that stuff. But I love it too, actually. I think Carol Kane is adorable in this movie.
Well, one thing that I'm sure is supposed to be adorable too, and doesn't ring true because the ending doesn't ring true for me at all, is when Grace's son does the Tiny Tim line, "God bless us, everyone." That's been in a lot of productions. Tiny Tim always spoke, and this one he doesn't. We don't really know why Grace's son won't talk. What do you think of that? Does
Tiny
that work
Tim
at all?
Is always the lamest character in every version of A Christmas Carol. And when I was looking through my notes from when we covered the Alistair Sims version.
Sim.
Sorry.
Singular.
Sorry. Alistair Sim version. Ugh, I'm a hater, guys.
It's
sorry.
Singular Sim. Glasses on the nose.
I had a whole paragraph about how much I hated Tiny Tim and how he was laying it on way too thick. It's so corny.
This turkey must be from Mr. Scrooge. How do you know that? I don't know. I just do.
So, was this a particularly corny version of Tiny Tim? Well, good luck
right in line
telling
with him,
a story
then. Okay,
where
fine.
He's not lame.
I'm sure not everyone agrees with you on that.
I'm sure everyone agrees with me on everything because I am frequently right.
But one of the best things about that ending is that great song, Put a Little Love in Your Heart. Annie Lennox and, oh man,
Al Green.
It is Al Green. I had it as a trivia question, trivia song for you guys months ago. And I think it was James, our friend, who finally came up with the mail. I think you all knew Annie Lennox right away. I don't really think of it as a Christmas song specifically, but of course it's used so well at the end of this film. Murray and everyone are singing it. Everyone's dancing. We see the various people at home and other places watching. That's an elf at the end when they realize that Santa needs help. Not the song, but the idea that people are watching on television and they're singing along. They sing Santa Claus is Coming to Town.
That's another movie where they imply that everybody is watching television on the same
the news
channel
at
all
that.
The time. Yeah, yeah. There's so many
watching
movies.
This show I buy. Watching the news and Elf, I don't buy.
Probably the worst offender of this of all time, although it totally works thematically, is The Truman Show. It's not even just that people are watching him always, but that they're always wearing the same clothes and in the same position. And
one guy's always in the
one
shower.
One guy's in the bath.
The bathtub.
He's in the bathtub. And this is a story that goes on for days.
Yeah.
And he's always watching from the bathtub.
Very
like
pruney.
But you're invested, and that movie's just so wonderful. It's just the last thing that you need to care about because you understand that it's an elevated reality anyway.
I just said
and
that.
And same with this and same with Elf. By the time they do something silly like that, you're just so fully invested.
Well, I'm not in this, of course, like I've already made very clear. And I said a minute ago that people would watch this show. And then I also said earlier that, are they really watching on Christmas Eve? Well, maybe they would if there's not many other stations to watch, as was true back in 1987 when they made the movie, in 88 as well, but they started in December 87. So they were shooting in the Christmas season the year before, and then it came out for the Christmas season of 88. But there are fewer things to watch, so maybe people would have been watching that. But watching the news and Elf, especially the kids, not so likely.
You work for a news station. Christmas Eve is probably one of the worst ratings you guys get all year.
I'm guessing so, yeah.
Although, speaking of TV, I do like the way they keep TV as a really through-line theme. TV is what comforted Frank in his childhood.
He's a TV-obsessed kid.
He's TV-obsessed. It's where he focused all his ambitions. There's the scene with the trivia where he knows everything, and he considers it important. He's chastising his brother for not knowing all these details that he knows because he cannot fathom that somebody else doesn't value TV the way that he values it. Then it's really heavily incorporated into the ghosts of Christmas Yet to Come. And his appearance, his face is a television. The first time we see him, he appears on the bank of televisions behind Frank. It's the message that TV is Frank's crutch. It's his comfort, but it's also the thing that keeps him at arm's length from the world.
And one thing about this movie that I do find understandable, we've seen this in many films, this arc. So, okay, I'll criticize it, but I do understand why they do this kind of thing, which is that you can't put your job ahead of your girlfriend, in this case, not family, but your girlfriend. But as somebody who does shift work, as somebody who works holidays, as somebody who's had odd hours for 20 plus years in his job, sometimes your job does come ahead of gatherings. Claire is a wonderful young woman, and young at that point. Murray just has longer hair. He looks exactly the same otherwise. I would say they make Karen Allen. We haven't said her name yet. Of course, Raiders. She's so good in that. And Malcolm X, she's got a small role in that. So we've covered her now three times and spaced out over many years of our podcast. She doesn't do anything wrong the way they wrote it, the way she played it. But it's still the idea of, but you're missing this gathering with our friends because he has to work. He's not saying, my career means more than you. It's saying, I have to do this right now. It's that kind of job.
Yeah, the boss just asked me to dinner. It's a big deal if somebody's ambitious. I kind of do take his side, except that he handles it so poorly where he's like, maybe we should break up if you're going to be the worst about this. The fight is maybe all of three sentences long. It's obviously a truncated version of everything that went wrong with their relationship, that he always chose work over her. But, you know, it's funny, you always make this point that movies are saying to us, family's more important than anything. Look at Richard Donner's IMDb page. This is not a man who was going home to his family.
He produced a lot of movies he didn't even direct, too.
Yeah, he was making a movie a year. Like I said, his TV credits are insane. This man never went home.
His wife's in the business. Well, he's dead, but his wife wasn't. Well, I guess she still is in the business. Laura and Schuler Donner. But yeah, it's the irony or the hypocrisy of Hollywood. Go be with your family from people that work 16-hour days.
Yeah, but I feel like that was just not lazy writing, but compressed writing, that they were trying to tell a story in a really small time frame of this relationship that went wrong because he chose his job over her. You get the impression, obviously, this is not the first time they've had this fight by a long shot, so that's why they broke up.
He is not enough of an asshole in those scenes, I don't think. That one scene especially, when he chooses the work dinner over the friends dinner. Because we see how much of an asshole he is as an older guy, the present Frank Cross, the 1988, 87, whatever, Frank Cross. He could have been played more of a dick, and you'd see that and say, okay, well, there you go, Clara should just bail on him. Because I think Murray really did, for the most part, or has, he's still acting, struggled to have romantic chemistry with his co-stars. I'm sure you could name a lot of love stories that work pretty well, including Lost in Translation. Okay, there you go. That's a good one. And so is Groundhog
Day. The most unlikely romance between him and somebody who's so beautiful and like a third of his age, but maybe one of the most convincing romantic matchups
he's ever had. But it still feels like that's father-daughter, actually, I think. And him and Andy McDowell, it works. But when he kisses Karen Allen in this, when he kisses Sigourney Weaver at the end of Ghostbusters, when he kisses Andy McDowell at the end of Groundhog Day, maybe Bill Murray's just a weird kisser. But it looks like they don't jibe, all of those actresses, with him. So maybe that's part of the problem, too. They do have pretty good chemistry when they're living together and they're happy in 1968. But it's 1971 in the scenes we've just talked about where he chooses the job over her.
You got to give Karen Allen credit for really selling it the best that she possibly can. Because every time you see her looking at him, it's like the light is coming from her eyes. Mm. And she has this big smile because she has like a pretty big mouth and she's just glowing at him every time she sees him and she's happy. Now, when I was young and less critical, I don't think I let myself get bothered about the fact that he is a monster to her in the present. When he goes and visits her at the homeless shelter, he tells her off for wanting to do her job because she's at work and says the important line, "Shake him off, Claire. If you're going to save someone, save yourself." Mm-hmm. And the idea is that's supposed to get under her skin. And if nobody intervenes, she is going to become a callous, mean person like him. Any woman who is not broken would have that encounter with him and shake it off and say, "Oh my God, I can't believe for a second I thought I could have gotten back together with Frank Cross. He's even worse than I remember."
You know, the funny thing too about the Scrooge story, save yourself. That's what Scrooge is doing.
Yes.
For a good reason. We all, well, most of us like the arc in this story that's been told so many times. Yes, he wants to help the Cratchit family, especially Tiny Tim, and he wants to help other people. But it's really more about what puts him fully over the edge is seeing that he's going to die alone. That's in this version. It's in probably all the versions of Scrooge. So in some ways, that's a selfish thing too.
Yeah, totally. And in this version, we don't even see the Cratchit proxy, which is Grace. She is going to get fired when he gets taken away and sent to the loony bin. She is going to lose her job because she has no executive to assist.
Right. I do like, actually, I think maybe it's supposed to be subtext, when he says, "If I'm working, you're working.
If you can't work late, I can't work late. And if I can't work late, I can't work late."
Right. Funny. Fine. But my point is, that's a way of saying, you're that important to what I do. Yeah, I need you to be here. Not somebody. I need you to be here. Yes.
Yeah. It's true. Because she's competent and she clearly works really hard. I wouldn't say she soothes him, but she seems to talk back to him in a way that even the executives are afraid to.
They're well, that's why Ellie gets fired. He objects pretty mildly to what Frank is saying and doing, so he gets fired. Also, Alfre Woodard and her family, the characters who play her family, are, I think, the only black faces in the entire movie. Yes. A lot of people in this movie, and most of them are white, which is also pretty typical for the 80s.
The solid gold dancer who exposes her nipples was black.
Okay, so some others, but not many others. Okay, so Bill Murray, we've covered him in Ghostbusters, Groundhog Day, Royal Tenenbaums, Lost in Translation, that small role in Tootsie. Chris and I have covered him, I think, three times for our Scoring at the Movies episodes, so Bill Murray's been talked about a lot. John Forsythe was in Cold Blood. Isn't he one of the cops? I think he's one of the cops in that. We covered that a couple years ago. But he's best known for his work on Dynasty, around the same time as this movie, and that was on television. John Glover, we didn't mention him at all yet. He's the rival executive who wants Frank's job. Had a small role in Annie Hall, which also is true about Carol Kane, but mostly did a lot of stuff on TV. Bobcat Goldthwait, who's been good in other films. I don't really like him as Elliot in this, actually. But anyway, he was in three of the Police Academy sequels and later became a director. And according to him, when Robin Williams died, they were best friends. Not just, that's a friend of mine. It was, we were best friends.
They came up in comedy at the same time.
Williams was also in a movie that Goldthwait directed towards the end of Williams' life.
I think Goldthwait directed a film that starred Bill Murray's brother, Joel.
Okay.
I can't remember the name of it right now, but I'm almost positive when I looked him up on IMDb.
Is it Shakes the Clown?
No, it wasn't. Curses. Well, anyway. I cannot remember. Anyway.
Alfred Woodard was in 12 Years a Slave. We covered that many years ago. And also Love and Basketball, which Chris and I did last year, I think it was, for the Scoring at the Movies podcast series. I mentioned Mitchum, first time we've ever covered him. Michael J. Pollard is the homeless guy who dies. Very well known from Bonnie and Clyde. And then there are quite a few Richard Donner regulars in smaller roles. Mary Ellen Trainer, who is the psychiatrist in the Lethal Weapon movies that's always worried about Riggs going over the edge. He's going to kill himself, Lieutenant. She's in this movie. The boss of Riggs and Murtaugh, Steve Kahan, I think is how you say his name. He's in this movie. He's the TV director. And we talked about all those cameos and big name stars. We've also talked about Donner, the writers. And the producers were Donner himself and Art Linson. Linson produced many good pictures, but Fight Club is one of the big ones, and we have covered that in the past. Donner produced a lot of his own movies. Then he got into producing the X-Men movies, so if he wasn't already set for life, he probably would have been from Superman and The Omen and Lethal Weapon and so on and so on. But that would have really set him up for life because he didn't even direct those, but he was a producer on them. Movies 185 to 1, we watched the DVD we got from the Toronto Public Library. Cinematographer shooting it, Michael Chapman, shot Taxi Driver and Raging Bull for Marty Scorsese in the late 70s and early 80s, and then also operated the camera on Jaws. And there's a ton of other credits for Chapman. He worked a long time. The editors were Frederick and William Steinkamp, so father and son, Frederick the father, William the son. Frederick cut Tootsie, and then Bill, William, whatever, worked on many movies with his dad, and then many since his dad died. And the composer, Danny Elfman. I just watched Batman Returns last night, Christmas Spirit, and you really do hear the Danny Elfman themes in a lot of films that sound like Beetlejuice and the Batman movies.
And Scrooge.
And this has a similar theme.
Yeah, he just seemed to be borrowing from himself a lot.
We've covered him plenty of times, To Die For, Men in Black, Spider-Man 2. So what do you think of the look, the cutting, and the music score?
Cinematography. It's good. No complaints, but it doesn't really stand out. The set deck deserves a shout-out. I think there's just lots of interesting rooms and spaces and smart ways that they create a real scene and create character with the scene. Frank's office or Grace's home. You really do get a feel for these people from all the details that were put into that. The editing is great. I obviously think it's funny, and that is one of the harder things to do. But also, I think one of the things Donner does so well is he makes such a watchable film. There's so much momentum in his movies. You do not feel the time passing when you're watching one of his films. He just has such a knack for keeping you entertained, and so much of that is in the editing and knowing when to have a chill scene, when to have an energetic scene, when to cut and move on to the next thing. But obviously, a weakness here, perhaps, with choosing the right take. I don't know. Bill Murray said that one of the takes in the whole film was the take that he would have chosen. And I think we probably trust his judgment more than we do Donner. So that's an aspect of editing as well, is choosing the best take of an actor's performance.
I've liked Bill Murray in many things, but I've also liked Donner's direction in a lot of things. So it's not easy to say I'm agreeing with Murray necessarily.
They're just a bad match. Very talented people that just should not have been on a project together.
You said in some recent movie that an actor, I forget who it was, could have chemistry with anyone. And whoever that was, that may have been true. But that may not be necessarily true either, because some people you just don't jibe with. There are some people you might think, as a friend or a lover or a filmmaker or a colleague at work, play on a team together, you jibe and you gel and you don't know why. But other people, you just don't.
Yeah, but some actors are so good. Karen Allen says that she has chemistry with the character of Frank. When I said that, it probably was about somebody like Sandra Bullock or Julie Roberts, these actresses who can sell their joy and their love being in someone's presence. And I have yet to see them fail to do that for me.
Okay. What happens next? Well, Frank is nice to everyone for a few months, like he said he would be.
On his way to the loony bin.
Maybe a few weeks, yeah. No job, maybe, as well. But then people disappoint him like they always do, and he slips back to being an impatient dick.
Yeah.
Because he's going to.
Goes on a binge of drinking and watching TV for a couple weeks in a row. And
well, that's another thing. When he sobers up, I did what on live television last night?
His redemption is so ridiculous. I just don't feel like he would survive the night without ending up in prison. So good luck keeping that sunny disposition in county jail.
Okay, well, this episode, our last before Christmas, has had some kind of sound help. Not a permanent solution. We don't know if there's really much. We did a test earlier. We're still trying to fix our sound problems, and we've had some outside sound, and my stomach making weird noises this whole episode, too. But anyway, if it sounds a little bit better, we're still getting there. We've been working on it. Hopefully, we'll have a proper sound one of these days. Meantime, have a tremendous Christmas or Kwanzaa. Happy belated Hanukkah. That's come and gone at this point. Not as we record this, but when we post it. And have a great time with family and friends, but be wise about drinking and driving. Don't be like Frank. Don't drink too much. Or if you're going to be like Frank and drink too much,
and sleep in the office.
Then sleep in the office, don't drive, and then drink all you want. In 7 days, we'll close out the year by tackling another film from 1971. Fourth time this year we've covered a movie from 1971. Harold and Maude, Dirty Harry, and I forget the other one. McCabe and Mrs. Miller. That's the other one.
They'll turn 50 this year.
Mm-hmm. But unlike the other three, this one was directed by a black man, and it starred a black man, and we have it recorded on the PVR. It's Shaft! Who's the man? Shut your mouth. I've only seen it once, and it was a long time ago, and I'm guessing you haven't seen it at all.
I've never seen it. I saw the remake.
So the coming attractions trivia for Shaft. Shaft was nominated for a diverse group of AFI lists. It made only one of them, but which one? Easy to find.
All right, so for the answer to that question, please check out next week's podcast about Shaft. For more from us, visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to us wherever you listen. All of our episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American films ever made, and hundreds more titles. And perhaps in exchange for all of this incredible content, you could leave us a rating and a review. You can make it our Christmas present. We're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. You can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. It's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. It's not case sensitive, and that will get you a 20% discount.
So again, Merry Christmas this week, everybody. And to end, I'll say, put a little cut in your heart. And say cut. Put a little cut in your heart.
And cut.
Every day, put a little cut in your heart. Say it again. Put a little cut in your heart.
And cut.